This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on July 13th, 2011. Today we're talking to Paul Betts about SaaS and coffee.
Hi, how's it going?
So, I think that's a great name, first of all, that caught my attention, but I've been playing with it and I've been really happy with it. And then you told me that there's some really cool internals, so I thought that would be fun to just kind of dig into how you implemented it.
Sure, sure.
So you work on the Office Labs team, right?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm a dev in a group called Office Labs. So our website is officelabs.com. And so basically what we do is, office planning, who is deciding, what's going to be in the next version of Office and kind of doing all this research. They have all these ideas, but, it's hard to imagine what they'll actually look like or if it'll actually work. So what we do is we build a lot of prototypes. We build, how does social networking and kind of the Facebook style of interaction, maybe not necessarily the content, but working in this kind of view fit into office productivity and working together in groups and building all kinds of cool prototypes. And so the last big release we did was this. It's actually a game called Ribbon Hero. What Ribbon Hero is, it's a game that helps you learn Office and figure out new features. And it's actually pretty fun. It has like the storyline where you're trying to help Clippy, who has come back from the dead. And so we do all kinds of different things. It's really interesting.
I'm of course the next thing. If it was coming out today, it would probably be Angry Birds somehow could be integrated. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I think the one thing I think of with Office Labs is I see really awesome, cool things come out, and then some of them I never hear from again. Do a lot of things actually make it into products, or is it?
They make them in. That's one of the disappointing things in Office Labs is that you have to be okay with your idea being accepted into Office, but not the code, right? So a lot of our ideas, especially in the next version of Office, are going to be in originally from Office Labs projects. A lot of different features in SharePoint and Word and PowerPoint are coming from Office Labs, and so we build a version and then they kind of rebuild it. And of course, when we build it, it's a prototype, right? We leave off all the boring stuff like administration and like localization and
right.
These things that take time, and we just build the fun part. So,
cool. So, how does that relate to SaaS and coffee?
Not at all.
Okay,
not
this is all. Just something that you're doing because you love it.
I thought it was cool, and I did it in my spare time. And I thought it was like something that I'd done a lot of work with the DLR with Iron Ruby and Iron Python, and I thought this is a place where we can definitely apply this and see if we can come up with something good. So,
okay.
And I really like both SaaS and CoffeeScript. I think they're both really interesting, and I think that they make I'm a desktop guy by my trade, I guess. But I really liked working with. I did a project in CoffeeScript, and I thought it was really cool. I think those two languages make the frustration of like trying to code in CSS and JavaScript a little less. This should have been designed better. Like who wrote this? Like what I have to keep repeating myself in CSS over and over again, like things like this.
Mm-hmm. Do you see, I'm curious, cause you said that you're a desktop guy. Do you see that kind of thing? It's a definite trend in the web. Do you see that kind of thing in desktop as well? Or just the general kind of like eliminating repetitive annoying tasks and kind of meta languages and, I don't know. I just wondered if you'd seen anything, if you see a similar trend in desktop or if it's a web-only phenomenon.
I think you see it in wherever, desktop development is kind of stalled a lot, right? People are moving on to the web and mobile, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you see some of that in mobile. I think that the biggest advances in user interfaces have come from XAML-based, like WPF and Silverlight and Windows Phone. And then on Apple side, you see Cocoa is really doing interesting things, right?
Okay.
But Cocoa, of course, they don't do anything to avoid repetition. You have to declare things 15 times, right? They don't care. But WPF was a huge step forward for desktop, the desktop world, I think.
Okay. So We just did a podcast about CoffeeScript, and so the way that Trevor described it is, you know, it was a nice language on top of JavaScript that kind of exposes a lot of the inner beauty of the JavaScript runtime that's kind of hidden behind a Java-like syntax. Is that what attracted you to it? Or?
Yeah, I was. I really liked the syntax, and it felt like when I was using it, it was like all the good parts from Ruby and Python, right? Somebody, you can tell that Jeremy's really into these dynamic languages of Ruby and Python and a little bit of Perl, maybe. Just like really like, he did a really good job. Like he implemented it well and he executed it well. It's really a pleasure to work with, to be honest.
I just have to say in passing that it's kind of, you work at Microsoft on an Office team, and I think people might be a little surprised to hear you talking about and really, you know, enjoying like Ruby and Python and being familiar with a lot of other languages. And do you find, I mean, is that kind of a misconception? Are there a lot of people that you know that are like you that are just kind of not as, or is this, are you kind of an oddball there?
I'm kind of a weird guy. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I really like C# and I really like .NET. But I also like these Ruby and Python and kind of these other more interesting languages. The latest one I'm trying to peel my way through is Clojure, the Lisp that runs on the JVM. It's super cool, but I think my brain gets exploded every time I try to understand any of it.
Well, I'm glad to hear that because I've had the same experience and I thought I was just dumb. And maybe I am, but but I'm in good company at least there. So CoffeeScript, I think, you know, if people are interested and don't know what that is, you can listen to our recent podcast on that. How would you describe SaaS?
So I would describe SaaS as, so, you know, they have in coding, you have this concept of DRY, like, you know, don't repeat yourself, which is awesome. And it's a great thing. And it's really important and it helps you write better code. But in CSS, that isn't possible, right? You always have to repeat yourself constantly. And so SAS, I think, kind of takes, instead of CSS, which was really thinking about like markup and documents, they took a little bit more of a programmer perspective. And so like you can do things in SAS like you can declare variables. So I can declare a variable that says like, you know, border color or something, and then just reuse it everywhere, right? And now not only can I update it in one place, when I read through my CSS, I can say, oh, that's a border. I don't have to think like, oh, is FF75 4.2 my border color.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. That's a huge thing, right? And you can do all kinds of things. Like you can say like, here's a color. You can take a color and then that equals a base color plus 10% saturation or whatever.
Right.
So you can do all kinds of math based on numbers, and you can do all kinds of operations on colors that are what you would expect. Right.
So then if you change your base color, all those other saturations still flow through. You have the same kind of look, but with a different mm-hmm. color.
Great. Or you can imagine like a gradient, right? Like the base color of a gradient, and then you'd say that the highlight is base plus, you know, 30% brightness, and the shadow is like minus 30%, right? I'm just making these numbers up off the top of my head, but
sure.
That might look awful, but I make no guarantees. So that's one of the big things. One of the things you can do is, what are essentially, they call them mixins. They kind of work like C's macros. So basically, you can declare this block, and this block can have parameters. And then you can take that block and put it into any of your CSS normal blocks. So that description made no sense. So let me give you a very compelling example. So you know when you use the new CSS 3 rounded corners, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't just say rounded corners. You have to say rounded corners, WebKit rounded corners, Mozilla rounded corners, Opera rounded corners, right?
Right. All the vendor specific.
Yep. You can create that into a mixin called rounded corners, and then it has a percentage or like a parameter. And then you can put that into any element you want, right? And so mm-hmm. then it handles not having to write the same, literally not having to type the same value four times. So you just end up having CSS that's easier to read, right? And
okay.
More programmery and less like I'm generating this file that is just kind of junk, right?
Right, right. Okay. So I guess just a lot of kind of common sense things that solve, instead of having to force yourself to think like the language works for you more like your workflow.
Mm-hmm. It feels more like a programming language than, I mean, obviously you can't do things like loops or, you know, it's not a programming language, but it feels more like I can set variables, I can, you know, inherit things. I can create little functions, if you want to call them. Mm-hmm. The other thing you can do is, so say you have like a root element, like a li, and then you want to style things under the li, like li, I don't know, bold, li, italic. In CSS, you have to repeat yourself. So you have to say like all the properties for li, and then all the properties for li under bold under li.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And so in CSS, in SAS and SCSS, you can just you can nest them. So like you create one big block for li, and then under it, you can create a sub block for bold and italic, and then it'll just expand it out.
Okay. And so like CoffeeScript, both of these things compile down to, so the end browser is still getting CSS and JavaScript, but you're able to write in SAS and CoffeeScript. Mm-hmm. So that brings us to SAS and Coffee, because you need a compiler then that does that conversion, correct?
Yep.
So one of the things that you mentioned while we were talking beforehand was the idea of death to fiddling, making things easier to, so you don't have to do a whole, so an end user doesn't have to do a whole lot to set things up.
Yeah, so that was kind of one of the motivations for this project. Without NuGet, before when you just had to download stuff, there's always a certain amount of fiddling, and you couldn't get around it. Like, you know, I have to download, go to thing, download some assemblies, and then, you know, with web projects it was especially bad because you usually had to change stuff in web config, right? But with NuGet, you know, you can change stuff in web config automatically. It just pulls down all the dependencies and sets it up for you. And so I looked around, and well, for SAS there's nothing, and for CoffeeScript there was some projects, like people had, you know, thought this was a good idea, but a lot of them required you to install a Ruby runtime, or no, for CoffeeScript it was for the SAS you had to install Ruby, and for CoffeeScript you had to install like Node.js or like fork mm-hmm. out to CScript or something silly. And you just had to do a lot of stuff. Like you couldn't just use it and go, right? You had to like fiddle with web configs and download DLLs, and it was a huge pain, right?
Yep.
So I really like the key thing to this project is I'll do all kinds of crazy stuff, so in order so that people can just click on that package, install, and then run with it, right?
Mm-hmm. And like I said, I've tried that, and it really was that simple. I did, you know, install package, SAS and Coffee, and then I wrote a CoffeeScript file, and then I referenced it as a JavaScript file, and then I hit F5, and it worked.
Yep.
So behind the scenes, you're doing quite a bit of work then to get this set up. Where should we start?
Sure. So it's really, these two are combined because they're both, I mean, from a technical perspective, they're both essentially taking static resources in one language, compiling them down to a static resource in another language, and then serving them up, right? Mm-hmm. So the compilers are different, but they both kind of share this caching layer. And so I was like, well, there's no reason for me to write that same caching code twice, right? Because really, you don't need to rebuild the file every single time somebody requests it, right? You only need to rebuild it when it changes.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Just to be clear, the compilation is done at request time, right? It's not like a build step.
Yeah, it's not a build step, though everyone wants it to be a build step. But I'm not convinced, right? Because it's really handy to be able to sit there, especially with CSS, right? Because you can sit there and, you know, hit a five, change a variable, hit a five, change a variable,
Right.
If you have to build every single time, you take your, you know, make a change, see the result loop, and make it way longer.
So then, you know, I guess the only reason people would want the build step is because, you know, you're concerned about performance. Is that a valid concern? I mean, with caching, do you see that?
Some people are concerned about that. I think that's valid, though. I question that, like, you know, that's going to make that big a difference. The bigger one is that you could get errors, right? So if you write invalid CoffeeScript, so invalid that the CoffeeScript parser can't even deal with it, you could, like, at build time get a bunch of errors and say, like, oh, my script didn't compile, I need to fix it, right? And so you could, if you made a change and then just, if you're using the runtime, you could not know it, right? Because sometimes if you happen to not reference that JavaScript file, or if it happens to work correctly, then you wouldn't notice, right?
So I can think of one reason that you might want to do a pre-build step, and that's if you're going to be deploying to a CDN like Akamai or Amazon, what's it, CloudFront. You wouldn't want to have to go back to the origin server every time you changed a script file or a CSS file, SAS file, I mean. You might want to be able to pre-compile and then deploy that to your, you know, from your origin and then have it, you know, drift out to all the edge servers. That mm-hmm. might be a good use case for wanting to pre-build and pre-minify, pre-compile and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are definitely good reasons to do that. Although I think that it's more, people want it more because they're not thinking dynamically. They're not thinking very JavaScript like. They're thinking C# like, and they're like, I'm supposed to build stuff and then run it. It's like, no, you don't have to. This is a new world we live in.
Yeah, the only other reason I would think about it would be, and we talked about this earlier, was making it a build step so that if you had bad CoffeeScript, you could fail a build on your CI server.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, that was anticlimactic.
You were supposed to argue. No.
You're just going
to
agree with me on everything?
I do agree, but this seems very reasonable.
Does that seem like... Is that something where, you know, if you get enough requests, you might put that in, or is that just kind of an opinion, you know, where you're like, hey, if you want that, go somewhere else, you know, there's other compilers?
No, I definitely think that's a very reasonable request. I might end up putting it in. I don't want to make the build time super long, and I have no idea how to write an MS build task. I've never done that before, but I'm sure I could figure it out if I dug around enough.
Well, so one thing also was in the recent 1.0 release, I noticed there was a package definition for Visual Studio 2010.
Yeah, so I can talk about that. I think this is one of the most useful features in SAS and Coffee that's really annoys people. So the problem is that, and this isn't even a bug in SAS and Coffee, the issue is that so Visual Studio doesn't know what an SCSS file is or a Coffee file, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what it does is it marks the file as the deployment option is none, right? You know, when you hit – if you select a file in Visual Studio and hit F4, you'll see properties and some of like, you know, build, content, embedded resource, yada, yada, yada.
Right.
It sets it to none. And what's even more like devious is if you take like files and rename them, like if you take a CSS file and rename it to SCSS – it flips it behind your back.
Ugh.
Right? And it's tricky because on your local machine, it'll appear to work, right?
Right, because the file's still there.
Yeah, exactly. But then a lot of people would deploy to AppHarbor, for example, or you know, any other deployment, and then they'd be like, yeah, this doesn't work. It was like my number one email problem that people were talking about. And it took me a while to figure out what was going on. Like, I was like, it works on my machine. What's the...
Right.
Yeah, so I found out one of the other contributors to SAS and Coffee sent me this bug, and he's like, hey, if you install this on people's boxes, then it'll work, right? It'll set the content properly. It's just this file that you put in this obscure Visual Studio directory. And so I was like, that's awesome. And so what I did was in every NuGet package, you get this opportunity to run PowerShell on their machine, right?
Right.
Which sounds terrifying if you think about it, but they've given me this advantage and I'm going to run with it. So what I do is I have that package definition file, which is basically a .reg file. It looks exactly like it. And it sets up the content thing. And so I write it out to a temp file and then prompt for elevation. So I say like, hey, you know, we can install a file on your computer that makes, you know, CoffeeScript less frustrating in Visual Studio. Do you want to do it? Yes or no, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they say no, we don't do it. If they do, I pop in UAC dialog and then use that to copy into, because it's in program files, you can't copy into it unless you're elevated.
Oh, right. Okay.
So but the idea is that, like, I really wanted it to be still seamless, right? Like, I could have just put it up on my blog and said like, hey, if you're having this problem, go do this, right? But this way, like, I thought of some crazy idea, but the idea being that it makes people using the package their life a lot easier, right?
Right. And I guess it's one of those things where you don't really know how much easier it is, but if it wasn't there, it'd be frustrating, like you're saying.
Yeah.
It's a surprise something doesn't work, and it's hard to figure out why.
Yeah, that property dialogue is like this, like, you know, you'll never find it.
Yeah.
Right.
And honestly, the... options are confusing. You know, what's the difference between an embedded resource and, you know, the different resource types, and just it's hard to know. Okay, so there's that. So I go through, I write my files. They are copied out with the build. Then when they're requested, is there a handler, or what causes the request that comes in for a .js file to find, you know, what does that mapping so that the .js file request comes to my CoffeeScript and gets compiled and all that?
So what we do on ASP.NET is it's an HTTP module.
Okay.
So it works for old school web forms. It works for the new web pages and MVC. And so what we do is we snag the file. We see if we look for the original. We look for the file they're asking for, because they're asking for the JS version if they're looking for a CoffeeScript, right?
Mm-hmm.
We look for the JS version. We don't find it. We come up with this version of a different file name in a cache directory if you're using caching. That's based on the last time it was edited, and like a hash kind of deal. If we don't find that file, then we actually end up running it through the compiler. So the compiler originally used Jurassic, which is this completely managed JavaScript engine.
Okay. And just in passing too, while you're mentioning that, and I'm sorry for cutting you off, but I've seen Jurassic and IronJS. And I wondered if you compared those or if there's any real difference.
Sure. My original plan was to use IronJS, but at the time, IronJS didn't run the CoffeeScript compiler. IronJS is like, I think, ES3, I want to say.
Okay.
The older JavaScript standard. They haven't caught up to the newer one.
Okay.
I could be wrong on the name of that. But anyway, so I decided to use Jurassic. I liked IronJS better because it's a DLR language. The other thing was it was written in F#, so if you've ever tried to use an F# library from C#, it's a little tricky. Like, the types are really strange, and there's some strangeness going on. So then I was like, well, what other engines are out there? And so I actually ended up using V8. And so what I did was I compiled V8. So V8 is a C++ library.
Right.
So V8 is the engine that powers Chrome. So Chrome uses the V8 JavaScript engine.
And it's open source, so you're able to do
that. Yeah, and it's open source. So I just you just compile it, and it's a C++ library, basically.
How is that working in terms of managed code? You're just calling right into it via interop, or?
So what I do is I created a C++ CLI library that is basically like the dumbest library you could possibly create to marshal the native or the managed strings and the managed source code into a native string, pass it to V8. V8 compiles it super fast, and then hands it back up. Right.
Okay. And it hands it back up just as a string. Is it just
as a managed string? Yeah.
Okay.
And getting that to work was this nightmare of spending hours in Windebug. V8 is not the easy. V8. The problem with V8 is that they made the fundamental assumption that they will be running on, like, you know, V8 or Chrome uses this multi-process model, right? And so really, at the end of the day, their JavaScript is only running on one thread, right? At least most of the time, from what I can tell. Yeah, that's true, because they even with web workers, they kick off separate processes to run them. So they made the assumption that I'm only going to be able to run on one thread forever. And so if you're an ASP.NET HTTP handler, you are not on one thread. And so it's even worse than, like, you know, just holding a lock, right? Like, not only do you have to protect multiple accesses to it at the same time, you actually cannot, once you initialize it on that thread, it has to live there forever. You can never touch it from any other thread ever again, or else it'll crash. So there was definitely some, it took me a while to figure that out, because the crash is completely obscure as to, like, what's going on.
Exactly.
I finally figured it out. And then the thing is that even when I have to serialize all of the accesses to V8, so it means you can only run one thing at a time. Even when serializing it and then all the other threads are waiting, it's so blindingly fast that it doesn't matter compared to when people would minify really large JavaScript files in Jurassic, it would actually take like multiple minutes, like 10 minutes on 64-bit machines, which is like unusably slow, right? So V8, while being a total pain, lives up to its reputation of being mind-numbingly fast. So this is very cool.
Well, okay, so you're calling down into it, you get back a string, you go through whatever caching you need to do, and checksumming. You said there's a checksum. Is it just a very simple checksum, or is there?
Yeah, it's just MD5.
Okay, and then it's cached and then goes on out. Is yep. it? And then, so that's for the JavaScript side. There's also another feature is Uglify.js.
Mm-hmm.
So is that's part of that pipeline as well?
It works. Yeah, it works really similarly to CoffeeScript. Actually, they're both a JavaScript implementation, and so I basically find a function that I can call in the JavaScript code somewhere. You know, I dig through the source code and find like the compile this string into this other string, and then I just end up calling that function from V8, like you doing the like usually in JavaScript engines, you have a method that will let you call a JavaScript function and pass in parameters and then get a result. So both of them really work mostly the same. In fact, like the differences between the CoffeeScript compiler and the Uglify.js compiler is just like a constructor parameter.
So is the Uglify.js, which if I remember correctly, is like a minimizer, whitespace mover,
yep,
yada
yep.
yada kind of optimizer.
It'll even do stuff like if you do a constant comparison, like if you say like if 3 is less than 5, it'll figure out that 3 and 5 are both constants and then just get rid of the if. It's pretty cool actually.
Oh yeah. So is that pluggable? Could you plug in something like Google Closure Compiler or what's the other one I'm thinking of? Well, Yahoo or any of those.
Yeah, so I designed it to be, you can have different backends, and basically the backends, the compiler backends are like, you register the file extensions you're interested in, and then the file extension you're going to output to, and then you get a chance to do whatever you want to it.
So how do I register that? Is that?
You have to, it's in the code, like in the architecture, like you'd have to compile Sass and Coffee yourself.
Okay.
You could think of like maybe in the future you can make like a meth version or something like that, right? Where it could look up. That'd be pretty cool actually. But right now you just have to hack the code. And it just has like at the beginning of like in the setup routine, it has like, you know, an array of like, you know, CoffeeScript compiler, Uglify.js compiler, you know.
Gotcha. And then how is you do file combining as well? Is that, I mean, I'm assuming there's more than just appending them together.
Yeah, so what you do is you create a file called a .combine file. And so it's really just a text file with a list of other files, right? So like you can imagine like maybe I want the production all files for this section, right? You can think of any like combination of source files you could want, right? You're not limited to like I must combine all of the files, right?
Okay. Like for instance, I may not want to combine jQuery. Because then I can take advantage of any caching or CDN or whatever, but I want to combine all my local files.
Exactly. Or maybe like you have like a section of your site that uses a certain list of files and then a different section that uses a different list of files, right?
Okay.
Or like the mobile section would use a whole list, you know, mm-hmm. whole different set than the desktop section.
Okay.
And so in the combined file, it's just a list of files, and you can also use, you can either specify like just a file name, like a simple file name, or you can specify just like you were writing a link in an ASP.NET page. You can write like /script/blah blah blah. And you can also inside that, if it's a CoffeeScript, you specify the JS file, and you can also say I want the min.js file. So I can say like I want minified versions of these files instead of, you know, I could have in the sample they have debug_all combine and production_all combine, right?
Okay.
And the production asks for them all the minified versions.
Does that also include files? You said you could write like tilde and whatnot. Could you also make that a URL to pull from like a CDN or something?
It has to be relative to your application. You can't use absolute URLs.
Okay.
Anything that ASP.NET's map path will resolve. I take feature requests though, and I also take patches, mostly patches.
So I noticed, by the way, you mentioned in your latest release post that you have just gotten some patches.
Yeah, it's super cool, right? This is like my first project that people have contributed to. I'm excited. Yeah, so Stephen Robbins, his Twitter name is Grumpy Dev. So he runs a project called Nancy FX, which is like, maybe not runs it. He helps out with it a lot. So it's Nancy, you know, Nancy Sinatra, you know, it's a .NET version of Sinatra, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sinatra, the Ruby, very lightweight framework. And so he's like, well, I want to create a Nancy version of Sass and Coffee. And Sass and Coffee was like me hacking around on the weekends. So I did not, there's no like extensible architecture, like proper design. It was just me throwing stuff at the wall until it worked, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really tied to the ASP.NET pipeline, right? Like it used current request everywhere and, you know, map path and all this stuff. And I'm like, well, and I was on vacation at the time, so I really couldn't work on it too much. But I was like, well, come up with an interface that's like the minimum amount of information from the host that we use in ASP.NET, and then I'll code up the rest. And so I was just expecting that, you know, I'd get like, you know, like a, I don't know, 10 lines of interface that said like, you know, map path, physical application path. But then he spent like a ton of time like refactoring the entire thing and like splitting it apart into like a core and an ASP.NET adapter and doing all this work, and it was really awesome. And I was like, came back and I look at the pull request and there's like 20 commits, and I'm like, whoa, this is awesome.
Those refactoring commits are either contributions are either completely awesome or just, you know, like an unusable nightmare. Like if somebody really knows what they're doing, it's great, because like you said, you're busy making something work, and so if you have somebody that's taking a step back and really helping out, that's great. But then sometimes you just get this like Rob Connery's complained about a few times, like, hey, I ran ReSharper, and here's, you know.
Oh yeah, that's the worst.
Yeah,
especially because I have an indentation style that's different from the style like style cop guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, people were like, the first thing they do, they fork the project and then hit ReSharper's fix change everything, right? So guaranteeing that they will not be able to merge anything back ever again, and like making sure their fork will not be usable. It's like, oh, come on.
Yep. So what specifically was added then for Nancy? Is this like full support? You can do everything in Nancy?
Yeah, so we added and I don't know too much about the details of how Nancy works. So basically he can reuse the caching and stuff, and he can reuse the compilers. But then in Nancy you get support for, so whenever a request comes in on a Nancy server for a CoffeeScript file, it'll be able to handle it. Right. Cause okay. Nancy doesn't use ASP.NET at all. Like it doesn't use the low level pipeline or anything. It's completely from scratch as far as I know. So it's super cool. Right. Cause they get, you know, when I originally thought, I was like, ASP.NET is going to be the thing where most people use it. But I was like, well, you know, the people who are using Sass and CoffeeScript are kind of like the leading edge kind of developers. And I was like, well, they might very well be using these kind of micro frameworks and more out there web frameworks. So that's very cool. I was very excited.
Cool. Let me see. So that was the Nancy contribution. Was there another contribution that you got, or was that the...
Yeah, somebody else had contributed another small patch. I'm not recalling the details of... Oh, I remember. He contributed, you can configure which cache you want. So just like small things, but like it's really cool to, you know, people are interested, and then they see a bug, and then they're like, you know, I'm going to fix it and then send it back. And then everyone who does that, I'll be glad to add it in.
So is that I saw in the release post on your blog this configurable caching support. So there's the no cache and memory cache and file cache. Was that the mm-hmm. that's what was contributed?
Yep. Yeah, cool. And the ability to configure it via web config.
Okay.
Before it was just like pound define. If you really wanted to set it, you'd have to.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So basically you couldn't set it like at the end of the day, like you'd have to really want that in memory cache to get it.
Right. Okay. So let me see. So we've talked about the V8 side and all the JavaScript side. So there's also Ruby work going on for Sass. So can you tell us about that? Is that, you said before that you're a fan of DLR and you're a fan of Iron Ruby in general. How'd that work?
Sure. Sure. So it conceptually, it kind of works similarly, right? You know, I took, what I did was I started off and I checked out Sass, like a copy of Sass the Ruby project, and then it was like, okay, how can I make this into one file? Because, right, it's a whole big library. And then so I wrote some code, some really, really janky code to run through all the Ruby files, and then, like, anytime they did require blah, I'd, like, pull it in, right? Like, I'd nuke the require blah and then actually write the file in.
Mm.
So that, in general, totally doesn't work. But because SAS was pretty conservative about how you use require, it actually ended up working after I did some manual fix-ups. So I ended up with this file called sasin1.rb. So it's like sasin1 Ruby file. And so then I can kind of go down the same road that I did with CoffeeScript, right? But one thing that's tricky is that, so when you get Iron Ruby, when you get the NuGet package, you're getting just the runtime, right? You have no standard library, even the standard library that's shipped with every version of Ruby, right?
Right.
Things like NetHTP or like even like, you know, simple things like MD5 or like, you know, all these standard libraries that are just expected to be there in Ruby. And so some people expect, they're like, oh yeah, point us to the path of your installed Ruby setup. And I was like, no, we're not gonna do that. I'm not gonna make people install Ruby, because then nobody will do it, right? Like, people are just like, install Ruby, I'm out. Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, like you were saying before, it's that extra step. It's the difference between like, hey, let me take a look at this, cool, it works, or okay, I should probably get to that eventually. You know?
Yeah.
Or I don't have permission to install this on that machine, or some lame, you know, just enough
function. Yeah. Works on my dev box, but then when I can't install it on my VPS because I can't install Ruby on my host, right? So what I do is, so DLR runtime has this notion of a platform adaptation layer, a PAL. And the reason they created this was originally for Silverlight, right? So on desktop CLR, file open would open a file on the file system, right? But on the Silverlight CLR, it'd go down to isolated storage or something. And so what I did was I hooked that platform adaptation layer for Ruby, and then rigged it so if you accessed anything under the directory R, so R:\blah, it wouldn't look at the actual R drive. We dig through the resources, the embedded resources in the DLL.
Okay.
So I ended up actually embedding like large parts of the Ruby standard library in the DLL, which is why the NuGet package is like 4 MB.
So this is what you were talking before with your kind of virtual file system that you've created.
Yeah. So it's actually like we'll try to dig through and look for, and it's only if it's a Ruby file. So I'm thinking of like, as I'm writing the list, I'm like, what's all the security implications of like me doing all this crazy stuff? I'm like looking through, it's like, can you exploit this? No. Can you do this? No. Okay, we're safe. Yeah, so we actually embed a whole bunch of the Ruby standard library, and then we look it up in the DLL at runtime. And it mostly works, so it's good enough for what I wanted to do. It's by no means a complete solution.
Is that something that you would think other people would want to abstract or use elsewhere? I mean, it sounds interesting to be able to embed, you know, like you're saying, all those standard library things as you need them, without requiring a separate install.
Yeah, well, I think it. Yeah, the approach is definitely reusable, of being able to knock out the PAL and do stuff. And definitely the code is on GitHub, right? So definitely look up. I try to comment the especially like crazy parts of the code, and it was like, nota bene, here's why we do this. Like, here's why we do this crazy thing. Paragraph. Here's why we do this other crazy thing. Long sentence. You know. In the hopes that like anyone trying to contribute will not like be instantly like confused and scared away.
Right. Yeah, I mean there's different schools of thoughts on the when comments are effective and when they're not, but that's definitely somewhere where when you're doing something absolutely non-standard and it's like you do need to express the intent sometimes of why, you know, things that are just difficult to find otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
I thought there were lots of interesting comments in the code. Particularly like in the JavaScript interop.cs file that explained some of the threading issues you were talking about. But
yep.
Also, yeah, also in the error messages, like heaven help you if you're on Itanium.
yep. Yeah, so because V8 is a native DLL, I actually have to compile it twice, once for x86 and once for AMD64, and then I embed it as a resource. My standard trick these days is like embed it as a resource. embed this as a resource. I do it all the time for some reason. And so, yeah, if you're on like ARM, or if you're on like, I don't know, you could do, Mono runs on PowerPC. You could be running there, right? So we fall back to Jurassic, basically. If anything bad happens, we fall back to Jurassic.
Yeah, I've been also going through the code too. It's great. And like you said, it's all on GitHub, and you can browse it all online. And it's cool seeing, you know, I'm looking at this, how you have that virtual file system with R. And, you know, I mean, it's definitely interesting, but it's not a huge amount of code. It's just, you know, like, I don't know. It's like those things where you're saying, where it's like a lot of work to get just the right thing working. And until it works, it just, you know, like with V8 or whatever, you just get a crash or something.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, is like, you have to like imagine how a developer is going to use it and know that they're never going to read anything you document, right? Like, they're not going to, if you have some weird bug that you know, documenting in a blog post is not going to, it'll help some people, but most of the people just aren't going to find it. And they're just going to say, they're never going to figure it out. And you're kind of like, you know, I don't want people to install a library I wrote and then be frustrated for hours, right? That sucks. So doing crazy things is always better than like distributed trolling the developer community by writing horrible libraries.
So I'm curious whether you considered or would consider, making a native port of SAS, or is that something that would just be so much work that it wouldn't be worth it? I mean, all this sort of machinations with hosting Ruby and stuff seems like a lot.
Sure. Yeah, I think, and somebody was talking about that for CoffeeScript too, like making a native version of CoffeeScript, and like you could do interesting things with that. But the thing I'd worry about is, you know, even if you did the work with creating it, and that's a pretty pretty huge undertaking, right? You know, now you have to maintain it, right? Like, and you know, have to keep track, be really vigilant to what they're doing, and then kind of merge it as you go, right? And it just seems like this situation where somebody would do it for a while and then they get tired and then it just kind of suffer bit rot, right? Like, I'd rather have like the official. And the other thing is, if you'd have to clone everything, you'd even have to like clone bugs in the original implementation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'd rather just have the original implementation kind of bugs and all, and then do what people expect. But somebody in one of the Microsoft DLs internally was talking about like a native version of CoffeeScript, like a CoffeeScript that ran on the DLR, you know, just as an idea, like this would be cool, right? And I was like, that'd be pretty interesting. You could do some cool things. You know, there's that original version. There's IronJS, but before that there was the original version of JS that worked on the DLR. And I was like, well, there could be a version of CoffeeScript that worked on the DLR. That'd be cool.
It's funny. I was looking recently at Zen coding, which is a way of, this is more of kind of a just design time thing where you can, a lot of IDEs support this, where you type CSS selectors and hit, I think it's control comma or something, and it expands out to the HTML that would have that would work for that selector, which kind of, if you haven't seen it, doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense, but you can, it makes sense when you see demos of it. And anyhow, that's implemented with JavaScript. And I was thinking like, oh, this would be neat to do in Visual Studio as an add-in, and was thinking the same thing. It's implemented in JavaScript and it's like, well, you could get something working, but then it's very quickly out of date. And how long do you maintain it? And how easy is it to maintain and test everything and all that. And I think that's a nice long-term solution, is just to actually run the runtimes, and then they work exactly as people will expect.
Yep.
So we had a question. We actually had two questions from Twitter. One from Trolls Thompson, who asked exactly what Kevin just asked. So we have that answer. And then the other is from Elijah Manor, and he asked, does the extension support syntax highlighting, auto-completion, snippet support? And then he asked about, you know, JavaScript generation and caching, which we've already gone into. But basically, all the kind of IDE niceties. And as far as I saw, there isn't any of that kind of language level support, is there?
Nope. Yeah, we're just, so I don't think you can actually, and I may be completely wrong, I don't think you can mess with the IDE from a NuGet package. like other than what I do, which is like just copying files, like, you know, on the file system, right? You can't. It'd be really cool if you could, like, if the Visual Studio extensions work the same as NuGet packages. Like, I install this NuGet package and then suddenly my IDE does something new and cool, right?
Yep. I've heard too, talking to the MVC guys and, you know, that also do a lot of work with NuGet, and they definitely wish it was that way too, because you can do so much with NuGet and it's awesome, and then you really can't do any more without, you know, a big installer that's going to, you know, or at least saying, go install this V6, which I guess is, you know, there could be a separate extension for Visual Studio to install those language services, but it's not.
Yeah, and you could, well, you could do it in NuGet if you, so you'd package the V6 in the NuGet and then just like on your, because you have installed PS1, right? You could do anything, right? You can do all kinds of crazy stuff. So on the install PS1, you could just like open the V6 and then, if they hit OK, then they install it, right? It'd be interesting. It's kind of like defeating the point of the V6 system because, you know, it already has its own update system. But and actually, I thought I saw, and I could be completely full of it, somebody had written a V6 extension for CoffeeScript to add at least like simple syntax highlighting.
Huh.
So it might be out there, right?
Yep.
Which would be cool.
You know, taking that to the whole kind of your install PS1 can do anything. One person that's taken that to a crazy level is Rob Reynolds. And we had him on before, back before NuGet was NuGet, back before they were working on NuGet, they were working on the new, whatever it was, new project. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. But he's got this chocolatey thing. And
yeah, he wants to turn NuGet into apt-get, basically.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. So it'll install any kind of application via, you know, so neat.
I remember seeing it on – oh, sorry.
Sorry, we were talking this afternoon. They published the MVC4 kind of roadmap where they think it's going, and they were talking about the recipes in it. And I was actually – you know, saying that right now NuGet is more like apt-get. You know, it just goes and gets assemblies, and yeah, there's the PS files you can run that could do extra things, but they don't. They're kind of limited in that they can't get to the config files very easily unless you want to go and parse the XML yourself, or you know, do all this horrible, awful DTE stuff through Visual Studio.
Mm-hmm.
But with the recipes and having that dialogue API, you know, I'm wondering, you know, what that's going to be in terms of being able to extend the IDE a little bit through a NuGet package. So could you write a recipe that would, you know, go out and build a REST proxy,
mm-hmm.
you know, or you know, pull in, you know, stuff like that to configure to attach to some kind of service, or even, you know, stuff like could you pop up a recipe and it really embed a CoffeeScript IDE in there? What? That's crazy, sure. Right?
People are doing all kinds of really interesting, clever things with NuGet. One of the developers on the Razor Vue, Andrew Nurse, was working on. He called it PSGit, so it was PowerShell for NuGet for PowerShell, right? Like you could, you know, type a command and pull down modules in it, but it used the same repository format, so your PowerShell packages were really just NuGet packages, right? All kinds of clever stuff, and I this is like a huge deal for .NET. I think it's really exciting. It's very cool.
Somebody had said if you think about NuGet as a protocol instead of an add-in, then you start to look at it a little differently. I forget who said that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely, especially like, you know, if you're using it from the command line, I definitely find a difference in the, you know, the way people think of it via if they're, you know, right click on references, you know, manage NuGet, whatever, then it's, you definitely feel more like it's like, I don't know. I just feel like I have more control of it when I'm using the PowerShell console. Have we covered enough about the internal nerdery stuff as far as how the code work or, you know, how things are wired together?
I think we've covered all the most magical bits.
Okay.
The only thing we didn't mention was that I actually shipped two versions of V8 AMD and x86, and I actually embed them as resources, and then detect which architecture you're on, right? You know, because SAS and Coffee is any CPU DLL, right?
Uh-huh.
So I don't know what architecture I'm running on. So I detect which one, and then write out the file to a temp file, and then load the assembly dynamically, and then find the class, and then that's my compiler.
So how is that detection working? Is that just a call to it? I haven't done that before. Is that just a standard CLR thing? You know.
Yeah, CLR farm makes it pretty easy to figure out what architecture you're on. I have to look up the function, but yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, then loading the DLL. Apparently, and it makes sense once you think about it, I originally tried to load the assembly straight from memory, and you can't do that with a C++ CLI DLL because, you know, with managed assemblies, you can load, it's just IL, right? So the CLR knows everything about that DLL. And with C++ CLI DLLs, part of them are native DLLs, right? So they have to go through, you know, load library, right? Like the Win32 user mode loader, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the user mode loader in Win32 you can't load a DLL directly from memory. You have to load it from a file because the kernel memory maps those DLLs into the process space, right?
Everybody knows that.
Sorry, I'm revealing my background of being.
I wasn't going to argue.
a Windows developer before I started my Office Labs job.
Which has obviously come in handy here.
Trying to figure out V8 would have been even less fun in Visual Studio. Visual Studio, just like you try to debug through it, and it's like, okay, I'm out. Like, I don't want to look at this.
So, do I need any special permissions or privileges in order to run this? Because I'm shelling out to, you know, this unmanaged code. Is that standard? Is this going to work on your basic, you know, ASP host shared hosting environment?
Yep, it works. And the only requirement is that we can write to app data,
okay.
which is almost every host supports. I'm pretty sure I haven't tried it in things like Medium Trust, but yeah, it the only special thing is it needs if your host only has is makes your file system completely read only, then it's not going to work. As long as we can write files. Then it should be good.
Okay.
I guess they could do some really crazy thing where like they mark the directory as no execute or something, but they wouldn't do that. I haven't encountered any host that didn't work yet.
Okay.
Though I haven't tried a lot of them.
But yeah, but Medium Trust seems like, I mean, if you're loading an unmanaged DLL, that wouldn't be supported in Medium Trust, would it?
That's true. Yeah. So we probably end up falling back to Jurassic, but Jurassic is fully managed, so. That would work.
Okay. And does that fall back? Would I need to recompile in order to do that, or?
No, it does it whenever V8 blows up in any way. We can't load it, or if it crashes, we just load Jurassic.
Oh, okay. I was wondering then. Yeah, I missed that when you said that earlier. I was wondering because I see Jurassic is still included in the application, and so I that makes sense now. It's a fallback.
Yeah.
I also see, so as far as testing goes, you've got XUnit for basic tests, for your unit tests.
Mm-hmm. You shouldn't look at the unit tests. They're particularly poor.
Okay.
There's a unit test framework set up, and then when people want to contribute, they're like, yeah, I looked at the tests. They don't really work right. I'm like, yeah, by design. It's not a good design. Yeah, so originally it was a little bit tough to test because it was all based on the ASP pipeline, right? So you had to like fake up you had to do host type ASP.NET, right? And fake up requests and do this kind of thing. But now that it's split, it's actually really, it should be pretty easy to unit test, and I just haven't got off my butt and done it.
So sorry, just going back to the V8 thing for a sec, aside from the, you know, trickery about actually loading the DLLs and the, you know, the processor family and all that stuff. It was actually interacting with the V8 APIs fairly straightforward? Was it a tricky thing to do from .NET?
From .NET, it's really tricky, right? Like, I'm basically like creating a C++ class to do what I want it to that has a really simple API and then calling it from C#. Using V8 from C++, it's hard to say because I'm really like they use every clever C++ trick in the book. They use like, you know, have you ever used this RAII, the where you declare a variable and then when that variable gets deleted, it frees the resource out from under it. So they do all kinds of clever C++ tricks that I intentionally make myself not good at because I think they're a bad idea. And so I found it hard to work with. Somebody who is really good at C++ would probably say that this is the greatest library they've ever seen, you know, designed perfectly. I think most of the problems that I had with it were due to my C++ noobness. So I think it's pretty like understandable. I think that some of the documentation is a little like when you really get down to like poking around at the internals, then you kind of miss like having really good documentation. It's not MSDN if you go to the V8 project page for sure.
There actually was a post, I want to say last week or sometime in the near past, where there's a blog post espousing all of the neat tricks and all the things that they did right in the V8 source code and pointing them out specifically and explaining why this is better than what you would normally do in C++. And I thought it was interesting that they went through the time to go through all the source to look at that stuff and were impressed.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely like it's written by guys who know what they're doing. And the cool thing is that even though the documentation is lousy, they have an IRC chat room where all the V8 guys hang out. So if you have problems, you can like ask them and they're pretty friendly. That was helpful.
Yeah. I noticed you had a cool list of thanks at the bottom of the page in GitHub where you thank them. You thank Jimmy Schmenti and Levi Broderick on the ASP.NET team and you know, people that contributed and everything. That was cool to do that. I know like as a lot of time as you're working on something, you go, wow, thanks a bunch, you know, but it's nice to have those kind of shout outs on there.
Yeah. I mean, it was really like SAS and Coffee is really just me patching together all these other people's work, basically, you know, them doing really awesome stuff and me just kind of making the little glue pieces so that it works with ASP.NET. And I was like, you know, let's call this out, you know, calling people out. I found like recently, like, you know, calling out how awesome other people's stuff is such a good idea. Like do it all the time. Right. You know, everyone wins. Like you feel good about it. They feel good about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
So what's next for SAS and Coffee then?
After I finish implementing proper unit tests, the biggest thing I want to include is this framework called Compass, which is kind of running, taking SAS and running with it. And it does things like includes the CSS grid layout, different grid layouts, I think Blueprint and 960JS, you can pick which one, or 960 something, I can't remember.
960GS.
GS, yeah.
Yep.
You're right. It looked pretty cool. Some people were asking about it as well, and I was like, well, I've tried to use it a little bit in Ruby and haven't got too far, but it looks really interesting, so that's kind of my next thing that I'll try to include. So you can like, I haven't went into the details of like how you enable it, right? Like maybe it's like another NuGet package that you install and it's like, I want Compass support. And then it sets up, you know, cause Compass has a little bit of a structure in the CSS. So it'll set up some of your project stuff and install like, you know, an add-in library or something.
Oh, cool.
But that's a little bit tricky as well because Compass is a pretty big library too, a Ruby library. It actually monkey patches, SAS and it, I can't do the same dumb trick where I go through all the requires and then replace them right. Mm-hmm. I have to be a little bit more clever. So that's the next plan and after that I don't know. I have a bunch of little things I want to clear up like on the GitHub. I have a bunch of like backlog of issues. But that's the big one is Compass support.
It really does seem like there's a huge amount of opportunity because you're able to include, I mean, you've done the groundwork to include both Ruby and JavaScript based, you know, utilities or you know, runtime, I don't know, other compilers or things like that. Neat. You mentioned earlier offhand, you know, the idea of being able to pull things in either as, you know, it could be MEF or you could just have other packages that drop on top, like, you know, sassandcoffee.compass and sassandcoffee. Whatever else comes along. I'm into BrainScript right now. I don't know if you've seen that.
I've seen a little bit of it. It made me. And of course, every crazy language tradition, they have to write the compiler in the language. And so they had, didn't they have a BrainScript to JavaScript compiler in BrainScript? And like, oh.
This is wonderful.
Like the amount of, it's so sad because, you know, the amount of like, you have to be a really sharp guy to be able to write something like that. And you're spending like literally hours of your time that, mm-hmm. you know, you could be like, you know, helping using software to, you know, cure cancer or like, you know, feed kids in Africa or somehow, right, do something. But instead they're like, I'm going to come up with this crazy, bizarre, esoteric language.
It's yeah. And that's definitely a place to get lost. And like you said, a little bit sad is to browse around, solangs.org, where they've just got all these crazy people have written entire languages based on one I was looking at recently. I forget the name, Shakespeare, and it'll compile programs that look like plays. So like yep. it's a sonnet. It's like, come on, man. Like you're
saying. or the white space only language.
Yep.
That one's a good one.
Good.
Or what was that? Was that the feature from BrainF that they didn't have go to, they had come from.
right.
And if you look at if you think about the logic of come from, it means that you're reading a whole block of code and you're like, okay, it does this, come from that.
Yeah.
And so this whole block is just wasted. Like it didn't do anything, right?
There was one other one I saw. Sorry, this is a rabbit hole, but there's another one I saw where it was things executed in different times, so it could. I can't even describe it. It was basically like you could it was like time travel in a programming language. It was just bizarre. So what else are you up to besides Sass and Coffee?
Sure. So the big thing that I'm really interested in is the reactive extensions. I was helping Jesse Liberty with reactive extensions a lot, and he's like, he's a big author, right? He's written a lot of books. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, well, let's write a book on this. And I was like, well, I've never written a book. That'd be really cool.
He writes a book at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
He's working on
like, he has like, I don't know how many concurrently right now. It's too many for writing, but I was like, it's cool. You know, so we're working a book on a book on the reactive extensions, for APress. And it's pretty exciting. We're getting there. And I found this out by looking at Amazon. The release date for the book is September 15th. So, and it's the first book on the reactive extensions. And Eric Meyer, the creator of the reactive extensions, is writing the foreword.
Oh,
so
great.
It's very cool. So I'm hoping to like bring reactive extensions to like the world in a way that people can understand, which is definitely a challenge, but I think it's important because I think you can do some really cool stuff with it.
How are you finding the writing process? Are you guys just splitting chapters up, or are you co-writing things, or how does that work?
We kind of work in a funny way. So I kind of write a lot of the content, but I write it in source code. Like I'm writing the samples basically. And so I write like whole big chunks of like, you know, if you write a linker reactive extensions book, you'll find that it's extremely tedious, right? Because you're describing every operator and there's a lot of operators, right? And they all do something really small. So you have to like all these little samples of like, you know, what does first do? What is, you know, subscribe? Well, subscribe isn't a good example because it's a very important operator. But like, buffer or window or, you know. And so you're writing all these little samples and you kind of describe, you know, here's what it does. Here's how you think about it. So I write big pieces of the book in source code. And then he takes my like, once you like stare at the reactive extensions enough, it like changes your brain. So you can't describe it to anyone anymore. But luckily that hasn't happened as much. Jesse is really good at explaining things. And so like he takes my like crazy chicken scratch in the comments of a C# file and then writes like legible English out of it. So it's cool. We're getting stuff done. It's
cool. Is there anything that you're excited about with, so there was just a was it the 1.0 release? I forget the there was a very recent release, right?
Of Assassin Copy?
No, I'm sorry. I saw that there was a recent release of both reactive extensions and also interactive extensions.
Yeah. So it's kind of cool. The reactive extensions start off as this kind of research. It was in a dev group like with what's it called? Dev something. And it was along with like Chess, the research concurrency tester, and Axum and C Omega, these kind of research projects from MSR. And then it was taken over by a group inside SQL Server called the Cloud Programmability Group. And so they kind of graduated up into a real project, and they've been doing kind of CTP-ish, beta-ish kind of releases for a while. And so recently they just hit 1.0. So this is like, now you can finally kind of rely on it. You don't have to worry about it being like beta, or you never really did. Like it's really well tested and really like solidly written, but you know, people always, they see beta and they're like, maybe I should wait for V1. So the right. V1, which is a really like, you know, solid base to start on, is out, and it's stable, and it's very cool.
Cool. And then interactive extensions, Matt Podwasaki explained to me, has been around for a while, just named, it didn't have like that official name to it. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it was in the original version. And so they did some originally, if you look at the code for the reactive extensions, it was kind of hinted that it would be included in a version of .NET, right? Mm-hmm. Like it was kind of like all the classes lived in like system namespaces, like system.link had all the operators, right? And so they kind of left that idea and then decided to put it into its own library. And so there's this one release where like it was a complete nightmare because all the namespaces changed, everything was different. And so as part of that change, they decided to drop the interactive extensions. And so for a while, you just couldn't get it. And so the interactive extensions are, so remember in the reactive extensions, that one of the big deals is that iObservable and iEnumerable are kind of the same interface, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you can think of like iEnumerable is a list of things in order, and iObservable is just a list of things in order that hasn't happened yet, right? And so they came up with all these new operators that were really interesting for the reactive extensions, and they're like, well, a lot of these work because these interfaces are equivalent, you could create enumerable versions of these. And so the interactive extensions are just enumerable versions of the reactive extensions operators. So okay. Some of them are really useful. Like if you're writing in a select many, especially, right? So you can have enumerable.return. So it's the equivalent of you creating a list with one item, right? Or a bunch of the operators that exist in the reactive extensions got ported over. It's just a bunch of like handy things that you can use with iEnumerable, including like, you know, everyone, every single person who uses iEnumerable ends up writing the for each operator, right?
Yeah.
And so it has one of those. So now you have an official Microsoft product that has the for each operator.
Yeah. And that's one of those, like you're saying, it just should be like, you do hope that gets into, you know, system dot whatever.
No, we're not going to go into this because it's just going to end up at Lippert's blog post where he explains why they didn't put it in and why it's never going to be in there.
I mean, Lippert is right. Like this, like the for each is like functionally wrong. Like it's all about side effects. It's not functional at all. It doesn't follow the monad as it were, but it's so useful that you're like, oh, why isn't it here anyway?
See, I'm sight impaired, actually. I can't read purple text, and so I just never I thought his blog posts were just blank. But, just kidding. That wasn't funny.
The worst is I tell you what the worst is when you say something on like a DL or Stack Overflow, and then Eric Lippert comes in and tells you not only how wrong you are, but you know that he's like so thoroughly right.
Right.
And you're like, oh, well, I mean, I learned a lot, but I also got completely and totally annihilated.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, but you might get lucky and have John Skeet show up and dispute Lippert, and then you're like, I don't know who's wrong in this clash of the Titans.
It's like, you know, Godzilla and Mothra show up and like, who's going to win that one?
I just had a terrifying Eric Lippert story. It was at the Norwegian Developers Conference. I was doing a talk on internal DSLs with C# and strange things you can do with Link. And when you give a presentation at the NDC, they have a lot of lights and a raised stage. It's kind of awkward. You can't really see the audience. And when I was giving this presentation, there were two or three questions from someone who I could tell was not a typical attendee. And I had pretty much figured it was a Microsoft employee, but I couldn't see who that person was. And afterwards, Eric Lippert walks up to me and introduces himself and said he was worried about what he was going to hear, but he actually thought came out pretty well. And I thought, man, I'm glad I didn't actually know who that was asking questions. I just would have, left.
So back to kind of the reactive stuff, Paul, aren't you involved in the author of a reactive XAML, or am I thinking of something different?
No, yeah. That's the reason, one of the things I got so excited about, the reactive extensions. So yeah, it was originally called reactive, XAML, and now it's called reactive UI. And so it's an MVVM framework, kind of like MVVM Lite or Calibre and Micro, that is integrated with the reactive extensions. So for example, in WPF, or you have this observable collection, which is, a collection that has an event attached to it, right? But with reactive UI, you get a reactive collection, which is a collection that has like iObservable for item added or iObservable for item removed, right? And all kinds of things to like kind of bridge this, reactive extensions is kind of a domain agnostic framework. It's like Link, it works with anything. But reactive UI works, attaches it to WPF, and you can do some really interesting things, especially when you can describe how properties are related. So like, password and password confirm in like a login dialog are, related to the OK button in the sense that I can push the OK button when these two properties are equal and they're longer than 5 characters, right? And normally you have to describe this in this really like, maybe in an event handler, you say like, is this and that, and then if you try to compose these together, it becomes really ugly. But reactive UI, you can say these things really succinctly, like I really want to say in a constructor, like the result color in a color dialog is the red and the green and the blue put together. And I can say that in one line in reactive UI. And it melts your brain a lot, like the reactive extensions and reactive UI. But I think once you get it, then it's really cool. Like you can build these really interesting things.
So we really should wrap up at this point, but I was curious. I'm just looking on GitHub. I see you've got 23 public repositories. Are there any other kind of cool ones that you're excited about that you'd like to mention?
Reactive UI and SAS and Coffee are my two big projects. Those are the ones that I'm committing to all the time. The rest of them are kind of little this and that things.
Okay. Cool.
Things that I like start and then never finish. It's like, oh, this will be cool, and then I'm like, oh, whatever. Wander off.
There, I think GitHub needs like a Farmville like thing where I read this article recently where it was talking about how Farmville is like preys on all the worst like things in human psychology. This was Kevin Dente. You commented on this. You Are Not So Smart blog.
And blog.
And they had something on there about Farmville and how it like made you feel like, oh no, I'm going to lose this if I'm not there. And so like you've got this kind of agony over it. So I think GitHub needs that as well, or anything else where it kind of like your repository dies slowly, and it like, I don't know how it
starts deleting files.
Exactly, exactly. Corrupting.
Or like other people start like publicly shaming you or something.
Right,
if you don't commit in time. Yeah.
Yep. Well, thanks a bunch. I really appreciated it. Like I said, I've been enjoying SAS and Coffee, and I do appreciate all the work you put into making it so easy to use, because there's all this crazy stuff going on behind the scenes, but really it was like 2 seconds to install and start using, so that was cool.
Cool. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. It was great.
All right. That's all the time we have this week on Herding Code. We'll talk to you soon. Here's an interesting update. Since we recorded the show, Paul's informed me that he's moved on to a new exciting job at GitHub, where he's working to improve the Windows experience for both Git and GitHub. So that's awesome. Congratulations to Paul and best of luck. I remember now, I'm sorry, but I remembered I was mentioning this ridiculous esoteric language, and it's called Two Ducks, which is a play on paradox, and it allows you to go back in time and modify the state at a previous point in the you know, as the application's running.
Oh wow, that could quickly go into Crazyville.
It's way beyond Crazyville. It's like all of a sudden you're like creating these paradoxes and trying to figure out what could have happened at different times based on, you know, I don't even know.
Did it replay from the point that you changed it, or
yes,
did it just?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
So, and it says it's uncomputable on a Turing machine, and it even allows you to solve the halting problem. So you know.
So like you could say like. A at time 5 seconds in equals 7, and then suddenly everything that, you know, happens from 5 seconds onward gets replayed.
Yeah, although it's not based on time, it's based on, I don't know, steps in, I believe. But actually it does have time expressions as well. So yeah.
You know, it's kind of interesting because I don't know, I was gonna say you could it might be useful with like you said, traveling salesman problems or things that could be solved with simulated annealing or those kind of, you know, get close to the right answer at first and see, you know, if you can optimize from there kind of things. So, you know, you take a certain path and you see if that gets you to the right answer. If not, then you go back to the point where you diverged, yeah, earliest point, and you try to replay with the other choice or, you know, another choice and see where it goes.
On a non-crazy note, it reminds me of, have you ever used PEX?
Oh,
the,
yeah.
The unit testing tool?
Yeah.
So they do the same kind of thing. They try to, like, yeah, use, yeah, they use, like, they think of all the possible branches of, like, how the code could go given the inputs, and then they use, like, a Z3 solver, like a constraint solver, to, like, say, like, okay, I can push, if I give these different parameters, I can push the code towards this exception block and make it blow up. Mm-hmm. Which is really, like, brilliant, but, like those guys are way smarter than I am, that's for sure. So it ends up, like, in when you use it, it ends up feeling like you just have a tester who's, like, a giant dick. Like, like constantly, like, what if I give you a string that's of length 1 but is a null terminator? What up now? And then something horrible happens, right? It does all kinds of just things I would never think of.
Very that's cool, how cool. They should have branded it.
It's like the dickhead tester you never had.
Yeah, or like the latest version does like if you specify in your code a regular expression to check an input, it will figure out you used a regular expression and then come up with patterns that match the regular expression by like running through the regex state machine backwards, like trying to come up with different things to match it. It's nuts.
Wow.